workshop on the Klamath River total maximum daily load and action plan.
The master of Coob.
Masters.
Chairman Anderson. Thank you. My name is Matt St. John. I'm the lead for the TMDL development unit of your staff. And I am here today to give you an update on the status of the development of Klamath River TMDLs. I want to start off by recognizing that I am simply a spokesman right now, and the Klamath River TMDL has truly been a team effort in the development, not only of regional board staff, but also working closely with other agencies. But with staff, I want to acknowledge the very hard work of a number of folks in the Basin Planning Unit, Holly Lundberg and Alita Mangelsdorf, and their work on the DO objective, as well as the environmental analysis, the CEQA analysis. And in my unit, Brian McFadden has been the lead on their temperature TMDL, the technical side of that. Clayton Krager has been the lead in developing the dissolved oxygen nutrient-related TMDLs. Ben Zabinski has been the lead in the development of the implementation plan with a lot of support and advice from staff counsel Olson. And Catherine Carter has played an integral role in just kind of keeping this, making a document that is readable and accessible to the public. And of course, all of this is under the direction of David Leland and Kat Coleman's integral guidance. With that, I get the honor of presenting all of these people's good work. So with that, remind me.
I'll try to point at the machine.
Here. So the purpose of this workshop is to first provide a presentation to give you an overview of the TMDLs. I'm going to go pretty quickly over the technical parts and the allocations because we have had previous board items going over this, but we're happy to take all the time needed to address your questions on that. Then spending more time on the implementation plan, which is really the policy component of the TMDL. Then we'll be happy to take your questions and then receive oral comments from the public. We are currently in the public comment period for the Klamath River TMDLs, and so today's board workshop, one of the primary opportunities, of course, is to receive oral comments. And then because we're in the public comment period, we are encouraging submittal of written comments from the public. Speaking about the public comment period, we have made the decision to extend the public comment period to August 27th. There was some internet problems a couple weeks ago whereby the state board's website was down, which meant our website was down, which meant that in effect the documents weren't available for a three-day period. So due to that, we have extended our public comment period by 4 days, and it will close on August 27th. We held 2 weeks ago public workshops, public meetings, up in the Klamath Basin over a four-day period and held four meetings in Klamath Falls, Yreka, Orleans, and in the town of Klamath, where we presented a similar presentation and received oral comments. We'll be having two board workshops, today's workshop and one again in September. And then we're leading towards a board hearing scheduled for either October 28th or 29th in Klamath. And I'll revisit this schedule after the end of my presentation. So needless to say, we're talking about the Klamath River Basin, a basin that covers both the states of Oregon and California, originating at the outlet of Upper Klamath Lake. That's what starts the formal, what we call the Klamath River, flows from Oregon into California and out to the ocean with significant tributaries that are connected to the river, including the Lost River in Oregon and California, the Shasta, Scott, Salmon, and Trinity River basins. Both the states of Oregon and California have identified the Klamath River as not meeting water quality standards, have put the river on the state's respective 303D lists. These are for common water quality impairments, including temperature, and then nutrient-related, biostimulatory-related water quality impacts, as well as low dissolved oxygen. And so these are the parameters for which both states are developing the TMDLs. Again, as you know, we've been working closely with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, as well as the two EPA regions, Region 9, which covers our state, and Region 10, which covers the Oregon portion of the Klamath River. We have an existing memorandum of agreement that was signed when we began this process to develop the TMDLs. We've been doing a joint technical analysis using the same analytic tools for the development of the TMDLs. So we're doing a joint analysis. Ultimately, it will result in separate TMDL documents because both states are maintaining our own authority with respect to the actual implementation plans. But there's a commitment to meet the downstream states' water quality standards, which is an important component of this memorandum of agreement. And then we've recently, end of last month, signed a second memorandum of agreement between these agencies to address implementation of the TMDLs, and I'll talk a little bit more in detail about this in a next slide. So getting into the allocations for the California portion of the TMDL, I want to give a brief summary of the allocations and identify the geographic overview of how we've assigned load and waste load allocations in California. And this starts at the Oregon-California border, goes through the river all the way down to the Pacific Ocean. The allocations are assigned at state line, and I'll go through that. Also for the Klamath hydroelectric facilities in California, COPCO 1 and 2, and Iron Gate reservoirs, the hatchery that services those facilities, Iron Gate Hatchery, and then allocations are assigned to all of the major tributaries, as well as to the minor tributaries, and several allocations that are what we call watershed-wide allocations. Allocations are set at these specific locations and at the amounts necessary to attain and then and maintain water quality standards. It's the purpose of a TMDL. This table identifies the specific parameters which we've set allocations for. It identifies, again, the locations where allocations are set, and then the parameters, including total phosphorus, total nitrogen, and organic matter, as the primary parameters that need to be controlled in order to meet dissolved oxygen standards as well as biostimulatory substances and related standards. In addition, we set dissolved oxygen allocations for COPCO and Iron Gate reservoirs, and temperature-related allocations for all of the locations necessary to meet our temperature standard. As we got into the development of the Klamath River TMDLs, it became apparent that the existing dissolved oxygen objective for the Klamath River is too stringent and is essentially can't be met, even under natural conditions, and in the reach of the river downstream of Iron Gate Reservoir. So because of that, we realized that we couldn't develop a TMDL to a standard that can't be achieved. And so we've gone through a dual-track process to actually develop a site-specific dissolved oxygen objective. And so we're proposing a new site-specific dissolved oxygen objective for the Klamath River. The TMDL was developed to meet this new proposed DO objective. And ultimately, what you will be taking action on, or what we are asking you, will be asking you in October to take action on, is two actions. One is the approval of the site-specific objective, and the second is the approval of the TMDL. Really, both need to happen in as a package. So moving then to the allocations, again, this is a pretty summary overview. Allocations are set at the Oregon-California state line. This allocation reflects a accumulation of the load allocations and waste load allocations that are part of Oregon Department of Environmental Quality's TMDL for those sources in Oregon. These are the reductions that are necessary to meet Oregon's water quality standards in the Klamath River in Oregon, as well as meeting the dissolved oxygen and temperature objectives at state line for the state of California. So I'm emphasizing that the load allocations that we include in our TMDL are simply a reflection of Oregon DEQ's TMDL. They do not represent additional reductions for state of Oregon or sources in the state of Oregon, but are simply included in our TMDL as a way for us, California, to assess the progress towards achieving the TMDLs in Oregon. So what these graphs show, it was a long way to get it, what these graphs show is a presentation of the average annual current loading for total phosphorus, total nitrogen, and organic matter as measured as CBOD, or carbonaceous oxygen demand. And then an expression of the allocations needed to meet water quality standards at the state line. The emphasis here is on the large magnitude of reductions that's needed in both states in order to meet water quality standards, or actually in this case it's reductions in the upper basin in order to meet standards at state line.
If I can ask, the reduction, just so it's clear in my brain, is the difference between the top of the high graph and the top of the bottom graph, or it's the size of the bottom graph?
The reduction that needs to occur is to go from current to the load allocation. So it is the difference.
And Matt?
Yeah.
And that's already written in as part of Oregon's TMDL for their allocations. So theoretically, if they're in compliance to meet those TMDL allocations, that's what it should be theoretically when it's crossing state line?
That's exactly right. That's exactly
Thanks.
Right. It's an expression of Oregon's, once fully implemented, Oregon's allocations, or the allocations for sources in Oregon. Oop. So then kind of moving downstream from state line to the Klamath hydroelectric facilities in California, KOPCO 1 and 2, and Iron Gate reservoirs, we assign temperature-related allocations, which address no temperature increase above natural temperatures. In addition, we are assigning nitrogen and phosphorus reductions to these facilities, and these are set at levels that are necessary to meet our biostimulatory substances objective and are really addressed to control nuisance algal bloom conditions within the reservoirs. In addition, a concept that we've described to you at previous meetings is that of the temperature dissolved oxygen compliance lens, and this is the concept is an overlapping layer or zone with temperature and DO conditions that meet standards and are supportive of the cold water beneficial use. In addition, don't have a separate side for this, we do assign allocations to the Iron Gate hatchery for nitrogen and phosphorus and organic matter, also to achieve dissolved oxygen objectives in the main stem river.
Excuse me, Matt.
Yeah.
taking this slide and then going back to your previous slide.
Yep.
Are we saying that once Oregon has, and I'm assuming that Oregon's responsible for getting to the lower limits on the right-hand side of the of each of those three graphs.
That's right.
Then when we get to COPCO 1, 2, and Iron Gate, that we are going to further reduce that?
That is right. That's correct.
Do and we have a quantitative, is it possible to give us a depiction of what will happen there?
Yeah. We have not. It's in our staff report, and we can pull it up at some point if folks want to actually see that today. But it's in the material in your board package. It includes graphs that make this comparison. We show current. We show TMDL compliance at state line. And then we show the loading that's needed at the point that of the river that enters COPCO Reservoir. And that is that does represent a reduction in nutrients. And I want to be clear that, that we recognize that's an additional nutrient load reduction, but it's a reduction that's needed to achieve our water quality standards in those reservoirs. In other words, the reductions at state line in Oregon alone are not sufficient to control algal bloom conditions in the reservoirs in California. So in order to meet those standards, what our TMDL tells us is that additional nutrient load reductions are necessary, assuming, which is the way that we've written this TMDL, those reservoirs are part of the landscape. And so that's the nutrient load reduction that is needed to meet those standards. It's complicated and complex and significant, and I see your quizzical looks. We can take more time right now, or I can move on to the, and then we can come back to it. It's your pleasure.
From the state line to COPCO is not a long distance. How are you going to do it?
Well, that's why I think it's helpful to move on.
Okay.
Because there are concepts that we present as part of our implementation plan that we believe are the mechanisms.
You're rowing the boat. I'll be happy to go.
And Mr. Massey, we'll pull those pages out for you from the staff report.
Thank you.
Matt said that the document was in the board packet. There's a two-page document from you in the board packet, but I don't think in those two pages we have all the information you were talking about. So.
No, it's in the it's on the posted on right. The web. We haven't printed the whole shebang for the board yet.
It had been my understanding that we were going to get CDs to the board members. Sounds like maybe that didn't happen.
We'll follow up on that.
Chair.
Mr. Dunker.
Just one quick question, Matt. The level that's going to be reached by Oregon at state line, that far the top, the box there, the lower TMDL.
Yes.
That figure was arrived between the agencies, between us and Oregon.
Correct.
And that is a figure. Is that a real challenge for them to get to that level?
You betcha.
So you figure that's probably about as far as you can expect them to go.
It is.
Or that's what's reasonable?
Well, that's what is necessary to meet standards at state line and in Oregon. There is, again, as we'll get into in some subsequent slides, okay. We believe there's an opportunity for kind of out-of-the-box, big-picture nutrient controls, centralized treatment solutions, that would allow for large reductions.
Sounds like we're going to get there.
Granted, those are would take a lot of money and a lot of federal and state coordination to achieve that.
Thank you.
Shall I move on? So in addition to the allocations for the reservoirs, we set nutrient and organic matter allocations for all of the tributaries, including allocations that are consistent with the existing Shasta River TMDL, as well as allocations for all the other major and smaller creek tributaries in the basin. And then, as I mentioned, we include some what we call watershed-wide temperature allocations, and these include riparian shade allocations that are equate to achievement of site potential effective shade conditions, which is consistent with all of our temperature TMDLs that we've developed in the North Coast. In addition, we're including temperature-related sediment allocations, and these are allocations to control human-caused excess sediment. We're talking big sediment sources that alter the form and of a channel that causes a change in a temperature regime. So that was what the section that our executive officer said to try to do in 3 to 5 minutes. So I think I've failed on that. Getting to our implementation plan. The implementation plan really is, as you know, is the policy part of our TMDL. It's where the rubber hits the road. What are we going to do about it to meet these allocations? Needless to say, it's a tall order, and is but it reflects our vision of a water quality restoration strategy for the Klamath River Basin. So what an implementation plan does is that it translates that the technical piece, the load and waste load allocations, into actions. And this includes both regulatory mechanisms that we identify here, inclusion of the waste load allocations for the point sources, and inclusion of those in federal NPDES permits, as well as addressing non-point sources through various mechanisms, which I'll go into detail in a couple of slides. But implementation plan also includes non-regulatory mechanisms, which really are expressed as staff's recommendations that are more voluntary in basis, or recommendations to other agencies of things that they can do. We have in March of this year, or late February actually, we put out a draft scoping document for our implementation plan, and then we did a road tour similar to the one we did 2 weeks ago, which were scoping meetings just on the implementation plan. So we received feedback on our draft ideas about implementation, and we have attempted to fold in the feedback that we've gotten from those scoping meetings into what staff is recommending now as part of our public review draft, emphasizing that these are our draft recommendations. I want to start with identifying what staff has identified as kind of the key areas for focusing implementation efforts. These are the areas where we see spending most of regional board staff time. Okay, so finally getting to one of the key components that have been deferring to is the development of what we call a Klamath River Basin Water Quality Improvement Accounting and Tracking Program, which we have fondly dubbed Klamtrack. What this accounting and tracking program would do is, but the intent is to provide a mechanism to allow collaboration among stakeholders in the basin on implementation of common projects that will be implemented, and will those stakeholders would earn credit towards TMDL compliance by participating in these common projects. So essentially, we are visioning the opportunity for offsets or trades as part of moving towards compliance with water quality standards in the basin. This program, and I'll give some examples of this in a minute. This program is very much in development. It's really a concept right now that we're developing. We're working in coordination. I should say staff is working in coordination with EPA Regions 9 and 10, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and significantly with PacifiCorps and contractors to PacifiCorps. PacifiCorps has already funded the initial work, having their contractor do some work in development of this project, and we are now integrating with that effort to develop a common program. We've received federal stimulus dollars to help pay so the agencies can have a contractor to assist us in the development of this project. And so we're in the process of developing a contract for that. Moving to the second bullet, one of the, you know, needless to say that the charts of the big nutrient reductions and then the additional nutrient reductions needed to achieve standards within the California reservoirs, there's a big emphasis on nutrient reductions as part of the TMDL. And these are reductions that need to happen both in Oregon and in California. And we believe that there is an opportunity to implement large-scale, what we call centralized treatment solutions. This is not a regulatory requirement. It's simply a concept that we believe can work if the money and coordination is there. But these large-scale centralized projects include things like wetland treatment, perhaps even harvesting of algae from the reservoirs and Upper Klamath Lake, as well as potentially even conventional packaged wastewater treatment type facilities that can treat water at its source, either at Klamath Straits Drain or at coming out of Upper Klamath Lake. We recognize that these are big picture ideas, but we believe that the accounting and tracking framework would be a mechanism to help make it possible. So now let me give one example. We believe there would be more kind of bang for the buck for PacifiCorps to contribute to nutrient and organic matter load reductions in the upper basin, as opposed to some solution within the reservoirs. So this accounting and tracking program would set up a framework whereby a project could be identified, such as a centralized treatment solution like wetland treatment, that would be implemented somewhere in the upper basin. The PacifiCorps would have some credit. There would be some ratio. They'd get credit for essentially buying into that, and that would achieve nutrient load reductions that would bring them into compliance with their responsibilities while being the most effective and both on a time and a cost perspective basis to meet water quality standards. I'm going to move on, though I'm sure that you have questions about that, or I'm happy to take questions. The second bullet item here is Forest Service. As you know, the Forest Service is the largest landowner in the Klamath Basin in California. And so through our timber harvest program, as one example, we have an ongoing regulatory relationship with the Forest Service, and we are going to build on that and focus on that to address primarily temperature and sediment controls within Klamath National Forest and Six Rivers National Forest. And then finally, addressing grazing and irrigated agriculture throughout the basin. And we believe that there's a need for particular focus on irrigated ag controls. And the watersheds that we plan to focus on at this point are the Shasta, because we're already doing that as part of the Shasta River TMDL, as well as the Lost River Basin. So I've mentioned a couple of times the implementation memorandum of agreement. In order to be successful to meet water quality standards in the river, it's going to take a high level of coordination between state and federal agencies. And this TMDL implementation memorandum of agreement was signed just last month, about a month ago now, by Kat Coleman and her counterparts at Oregon DEQ and EPA Regions 9 and 10. And this memorandum of agreement is specific towards implementation of the TMDLs and includes commitment to develop this basin-wide accounting and tracking program, coordination on water quality monitoring activities, coordination on how enforcement is done, coordination on development of a joint adaptive management program, and then coordination on working jointly with common implementation measures. I'm sorry, common implementation parties. Which brings me to the implementation within the Lost River Basin. A critical component of coordination is in the Lost River Basin, and we are proposing the development of a management agency agreement between our office and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so this is to address the controls to be implemented in the Lost River Basin in California, including the Klamath Irrigation Project, the Bureau of Reclamation's Klamath Irrigation Project, as well as the wildlife refuges that are operated and managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Going back to the implementation MOA, we're proposing that this memorandum of agency agreement would be between our agency and the federal agencies. To make it truly work, it's going to also require coordination, obviously, with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And so we are looking to Oregon to perhaps partner with us in this joint effort. Do you have anything to add on that, David? Okay. I'm going to move on now to implementation associated with the Klamath Hydroelectric Project facilities in California. The owner of the hydroelectric facilities, as you know, is PacifiCorp, and our implementation plan requires that PacifiCorp develop an implementation plan which will tell us how the company plans to come into compliance with the TMDL requirements and meet water quality standards. We are recommending that this would be a plan that would be submitted to you, the board, and following your approval, that PacifiCorp would then need to implement the plan in order to come into compliance with the TMDL and come into compliance with standards. Now, it's staff's expectation that our TMDL, the allocations and the targets, will be incorporated in a water quality certification that would be issued by the State Water Resources Control Board as part of the relicensing of the Klamath Hydroelectric Project facilities. And that in addition, since the TMDL has become incorporated into our basin plan, it is our expectation that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, would consider the TMDL in issuing a new license. Now, I know that all of you are thinking, well, what are you talking about? There's this dam decommissioning discussions that are going on, and we recognize that very much. But our TMDL implementation plan is written to address the current, essentially, regulatory framework, which is that the dams are in place. In order to have a new license, the dams need to get a water quality certification by the State Water Resources Control Board. to then get the license from FERC. So that's the way we describe our implementation plan. That's our vision for an implementation. With that said, there is this agreement in principle that I know you're all familiar with that was announced last fall an agreement in principle to remove four of the dams, Iron Gate, Kupka 1 and 2, and J.C. Boyle. And it was signed by representatives of the federal government, states of Oregon, state of California, and PacifiCorp. Again, as you know, regional board was not a party to these agreements, nor the Klamath restoration agreement. But staff have been asked and have provided input on appropriate interim water quality measures, and those recommendations, our input, have been consistent with our TMDL allocations and targets. Okay to move on? Okay. So with respect to Iron Gate Hatchery, as I mentioned, we do set waste load allocations for nutrients and organic matter. And these waste load allocations will be expressed as new effluent limits in a revised permit for this facility. This is a permit that is it's a joint permit to the California Department of Fish and Game, which operates the facility, as well as PacifiCorp. We anticipate completing the development of a revised NPDES permit for Iron Gate Hatchery that would come before you sometime next year in 2010. Iron Gate Hatchery is the only individual facility within the Klamath Basin in California that has an NPDES permit, and it's the only facility that receives an explicit waste load allocation as part of this TMDL. There are other NPDES permittees in the Klamath Basin, and those include our general construction stormwater permit and the Caltrans permit for Caltrans roads. All other sources in the basin, from a regulatory standpoint, are considered non-point sources, and so therefore don't receive revised NPDES permits. I know you're all familiar with the State Water Resources Control Board's non-point source policy. This is a policy that was adopted by the State Board in 2004, and it essentially requires that all discharges of waste, including all non-point sources, to be regulated through one of three mechanisms. Regional boards are required to comply with this state board policy, and the development of TMDL implementation plans really serves as our opportunity to incorporate the policy in our regulatory mechanisms for non-point sources. So what these three different regulatory mechanisms are includes, I'm going to start with a permit, which is called a waste discharge requirement. These can be either general or individual waste discharge requirement permits. These permits typically have a fee and typically are descriptive and can include effluent limits. Second, option to be consistent with the non-point source policy is the development of a conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements. And conditional waivers generally don't have a fee, though some can. And a conditional waiver is conditional. It's based on doing some actions that, if implemented, allow the discharger to not have to submit an intent for a waste discharge requirement. And in some cases, the waiver may be based on our board or staff certifying some other entity's program. And I'll give an example of that a little later. And now the third option is a prohibition. And I'm going to give two examples, or we're proposing two prohibitions as part of this TMDL, and so I'll describe those in more detail. Generally, you go from more descriptive and prescriptive as you go from moving from prohibitions to waste discharge requirement permits. So, as I mentioned, we are proposing, as part of this TMDL, two prohibitions as tools for implementing the Klamath River TMDL. The first is a conditional prohibition on the discharge of human-caused excess sediment. I want to say that the word prohibition is kind of makes everybody's, you know, freak out. it's a regulatory term, and that's why we use it. It's part of the non-point source policy. It's part of the law, so that's why we use the term prohibition. I want to emphasize that what we're talking about as part of this prohibition is control of what we call excess sediment from human-caused sources. Really, what we're talking about is human-caused sediment that is in amounts that are deleterious to beneficial uses. So you've heard this before. We're not talking about a teaspoon of dirt. We're talking about large sources of sediment that impact beneficial uses. So that's what this prohibition is getting at. The mechanisms for implementation of it include doing an inventory of sediment sources and then implementing measures to prevent and minimize the discharge of those sources. So essentially, when minimized, when those sources are minimized, we're really talking about it's essentially a low threat, and that's the way we see it. So what a prohibition covers is all discharges that are not covered by some other existing waste discharge requirement permit or a conditional waiver of a WDR. So it's really a gap filler. It covers everybody else. And it's really to provide coverage for folks that are have those type of sources and aren't covered by another permitting mechanism. So I'm going to go on. So I mentioned that we are recommending two prohibitions as part of this implementation plan. As we've developed the Klamath River Temperature TMDL, our analysis has really highlighted how critical thermal refugia are in the Klamath River Basin. We all know that the Klamath River gets hot, gets warm in the summer, and it's naturally hot and warm. Human impacts have exacerbated that, but even naturally, it's a hot river. And what has allowed for that reality and the reality that the Klamath was the second greatest, largest salmonid producer in California was the existence of what we call thermal refugia. And thermal refugia, in simple terms, are areas of cooler water that are places where that provide a refuge where fish, cold water fish, can go and kind of hold out when conditions in the main stem are too hot. So they go there, they hold out, they feed, and then they're able to go back into the river at night, typically, when things cool down and feed and do their thing or continue their migration, either upstream or down. Okay, so we identified how important thermal refugia are. That's no big news in some ways. But we're including, as part of our recommendation, a prohibition on the discharge of waste within an in-stream buffer area near known thermal refugia locations. And so what this is intended to do is to restrict the discharge of waste within, again, it's in-stream buffer areas. We're not talking above out of the water. We're talking in the actual thermal refugia, in-stream restrictions on discharge. And the primary use that we see this applying to is suction dredging, though there may be other in-stream activities, other stream bank alteration type activities that this could apply to. Now, with respect to suction dredging, there are a number of other kind of processes that are going on that have implications for this proposed prohibition on in-stream activities in thermal refugia. The California Department of Fish and Game has historically and is still currently the agency that permits suction dredging in the state of California. And based on a court decision several years ago, the court has required Department of Fish and Game to complete an environmental analysis under CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, to assess the impacts of suction dredging on aquatic life, and then to revise an existing permit. So that's an ongoing ongoing effort, though it's my understanding that due to funding issues, Fish and Game actually hasn't started that analysis to date. Now, in addition, the Senate recently passed Senate Bill 670. This is Patricia Wiggins' bill, which is would be a moratorium on suction dredging throughout the state of California. This literally happened within the last couple of weeks. It's been approved by Senate, but as I understand it, to date, the governor hasn't signed it. So that moratorium would have implications on on the implementation of our prohibition. And then the third component is that our staff council is currently doing some additional legal research related to suction dredging. And so we're still evaluating how this proposed prohibition would apply to suction dredging. Currently, it's as written in our staff report, but want you to know that we're kind of reevaluating that draft recommendation.
Heidi.
How does that collide with my
I'm just going to defer to you.
Samantha Olson, your staff counsel. That's one of the legal issues that we're exploring at this time, and we'll bring it back to you for a more comprehensive discussion at a later date. I mean, the Mining Act of 1872 allows folks to get claims on federal land, so there's just all these legal issues involved in that. Who owns the bed and banks in the Klamath? Can you prohibit certain types of mining? We have good case law that says you can't mine. You still need to comply with environmental laws. And so that's just one of several areas of legal research that I'm conducting at this time. So you'll hear more about it.
Matt, you said that the governor has not signed this. Has it gone through both the Senate and the Assembly at this point?
I know it's gone through the Senate.
It has gone through both.
Our executive officers.
That's my understanding, is that it's on the governor's desk.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Hales.
Matt, you have suction dredging here listed as a threat or an effect to known thermal refugia areas. And maybe you can explain to me a little bit. With suction dredging, I'm pretty clear on the concept of how it can generate turbidity and fine sediment. What's our linkage here to affecting thermal refugia?
Well, it's really two components. We're linking it to temperature impairment in the sense that suction dredging can have a discharge of large material, depending on the size of the hose, I guess you call it,
mm-hmm.
Which that those large material cobble can lead to the filling of refusal area and therefore essentially decrease the available volume of available thermal refugia. So that's the first. And granted, there's not a lot of data on the and studies on this, but that's what our analysis is based on. In addition, we are basing it on the fact that there have been studies that demonstrate that suction dredging itself can cause impacts, essentially disturb aquatic life that are in these areas and cause them to move out. And there are studies that our staff have reviewed that demonstrate that. And so that's not specifically effect on temperature, but it's an effect on uses within thermal refugia.
Sure. I see we're kind of walking a fine line here with that. And you know, I might also want to point you or other staff to work by Gordon Grant or Barbara Burkholder on hyperreic flow and how sediment deposits can actually increase cold water. That could be a flip side of that argument that you have. So not to say that, you know, suction dredging is going to actually create new alluvial features that are going to be beneficial, but that might be, you know, another side of the coin to be looking at with this. So it sounds this is kind of like an emerging topic of discussion, but is to I don't want to proceed hastily into this to throw suction dredging into being bad for thermal refugia if we can't establish some of those direct linkages.
Mr. Corbett.
That's fine. It is a recommendation.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I see a lot of potential pushback on that.
Well, I see the pushback, but if you have like the Blue Creek thermal refugia, what has up to 5,000 adult salmon, if you had dredge mining there that kicked them out of that, you're going to have a massive fish kill almost right away. So I think they're where the fish hang out, and you have to have, and it's not all the year, but they got to have some place where they can hang out. And you have dredge mining right in the middle of a refugia, it's going to kick them out. So I think there are some direct possible links, and it's more going to be our ability to map and have some kind of clearly identified system for people to even understand.
Sure, and I agree. Yeah. I fully support that, and I think that there's areas of sensitive habitat, there's seasonal use, there's spawning habitat, rearing habitat, overwintering habitat, and certain areas are going to be more sensitive than other areas to doing that. And so just a blanket prescription that might apply to all suction dredge mining, there may be some claims in bedrock reaches that don't hold fish whatsoever, but
right. There's
material passing through that might be far less sensitive to that activity.
I'll just state quickly that our staff, Ben Zabinski, did outreach with fisheries biologists that do work in the basin to try to get an inventory of the known thermal refugia locations with a particular emphasis on the refugia locations that are used by salmonids. It's a big list.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that. And we recognize that there probably needs to be a mechanism to allow for adjustment of that list as we learn more.
Look forward to hearing more.
Good, thanks. Okay.
Matt, hold on once.
Yeah, yeah.
Ms. Harris.
How many of those sites that were listed, the list of many, have actual mining sites at the mouth of the creek coming into the river?
I don't actually know that.
Is there a big overlay, or is there just a few? Or
Ben, why don't you come up just real quick? Ben Zabinski, staff of your staff, did this research.
This is Ben Zabinski. I'm not sure where the mining claims are, and I guess I wouldn't know how to find that out. Would you have a suggestion?
Oh, all the mining claims have to be listed. I'm not sure who governs those, but if you have a mining claim, it's well reported, it's documented, and the rights are listed with that.
So you're saying some of the areas aren't an issue because there wouldn't be a mining claim there anyway.
Mm-hmm. It'd just be interesting to see an overlay of how many there are in reference to that.
Well, yeah, it seems like we're also branching into areas that Fish and Game has a charge of evaluating right now, and whether they are or they aren't, you know, maybe we can, you know, help engage them with some of this, because we have a need to know some of this, these answers, and they may already have some, you know, they may not be working at, you know, 100% effort on it, but there's clearly some information. So I think that perhaps, you know, engaging with them on this, we may learn a lot. If you have
and the chair wants to move along, just the sense of we don't have the information today, but I'm sure the questions are known, and at some point we'll see it.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, agree with that sentiment completely. I think our interest here is to protect thermal refugia. Get diverted into the suction dredge part right away, I understand that, and we'd love to find a way to avoid that diversion while being able to protect the refugia. So any thoughts that you might have on how we can protect those refugia, because that's what we need to do, and suction dredge is just one of the issues.
Okay, with that good segue, we'll move to kind of other land uses that we've identified in our TMDL as sources of that produce sources of pollutants, or that are sources of pollutants in the Klamath Basin contributing to the water quality impairments. And these include timber harvest activities, roads, both construction and maintenance of roads, grazing activities, and irrigated agriculture. So these non-point sources are ones that we're now trying to incorporate the various permitting mechanisms. So these are what's summarized in this pretty complicated table. But this identifies the regulatory mechanisms that we're recommending for various non-point source categories, including timber harvest, roads, grazing, and irrigated ag. For timber harvest, we have existing waste discharge requirements and a waiver for timber harvest activities on non-federal lands. That's not going to change. For timber harvest activities on federal lands, we have a waiver that's existing and is being revised this year. For the non-timber related activities, kind of everything else on federal lands, so that's both U.S. Forest Service and BLM, we are proposing development of forest-by-forest waivers. These would be general waivers that would be developed over the period of years to address essentially all other non-point source activities in the basin. So these would be conditional waivers. And finally, with respect to county roads, we're recommending the development of a conditional waiver for road maintenance. And what we are recommending is that our agency would certify the 5-county Salmonid Conservation Program, known as 5C, which addresses road maintenance activities. Currently, this is being incorporated in Siskiyou, Humboldt, Del Norte, and Trinity counties. So we're proposing that we would take an action to certify the program and then develop a conditional waiver that serves as the mechanism for the counties to be in compliance with the TMDL through this action that would happen as part of adoption of the TMDL. In addition, we are recommending the development of developing new basin-wide waivers or waste discharge requirements for grazing and irrigated agriculture. I should say that based on comments that we're receiving so far, both during our scoping meetings and in our public meetings 2 weeks ago, staff is really leaning towards having these be waivers, though there may be instances where individual WDRs are applicable. So these are waivers that would be developed over a number of years following adoption of the TMDLs.
Excuse me, Matt.
Yes.
You're saying it's 5C, 5 counties, but I only count 4 there. Who's missing?
Mendocino is not part of, is part of 5C, but is not part of the Klamath Basin. So that's
okay. So they'd be exempt from this portion of it.
We may choose to include them, but it just wouldn't be part of the Klamath action plan. Is that what you're going to say?
That's what I was going to say.
So it would apply to them and obviously would go into Mendocino County, which would include rivers such as the Eel and others.
I think when the board, when we bring something to the board and, well, when we start the process of bringing that permit and developing that permit, I think one of the questions we will be asking the board is, Klamath Action Plan directs us to do this in the Klamath Basin. Should we expand it to cover Mendocino or not? So I guess I would see that decision either you can tell us now or you can tell us later as we work on that permit.
Later's better.
Okay. Okay. I like it. Okay, so I'm going to move to the next slide, which is remind you that when we developed the Scott River TMDL, State Board, there was a big issue about compliance with our non-point source policy as part of the Scott River TMDL action plan. And essentially we were required to develop, in retrospect, an interim conditional waiver. So we're learning from past experience, and we're now proposing development of an interim general conditional waiver that would address discharges that are not already regulated through some existing waiver or waste discharge requirement or through the sediment prohibition that's being recommended as part of this TMDL. This interim general conditional waiver would provide coverage to the land uses that I described previously. This would be a conditional waiver and would require implementing measures to be compliant with the sediment prohibition for meeting our riparian shade allocations. And in the case of grazing and irrigated ag, an expectation to develop water quality management plans in this interim period until a new waiver or individual WDRs are developed. Now, one of the areas that we got some good questions and comments about when we were up north 2 weeks ago was, frankly, a perception that the Klamath River TMDL was kind of superseding the existing TMDL action plans that we're working on. We believe that that is, we're trying to blend them. And so this slide identifies the relationship between the Klamath River TMDL action plans and recommendations with the existing requirements in the Scott and the Shasta TMDL action plans. The Klamath TMDL action plan does recommend the implementation of the Scott River Watershed Groundwater Study Plan. So that is essentially new. We're recommending the implementation of the study that's going on now and implementing what we learned from that study. With regard to the future basin-wide grazing and irrigated agriculture waivers, we are suggesting that these would be Klamath River basin-wide waivers. So they would include the Scott and the Shasta as well as the Lost. The reason that we're proposing basin-wide is to have so that similar activities are handled through the same mechanisms. And we believe this is to be simple, fair, and consistent basin-wide. With this said, we foresee these future basin-wide waivers would serve as the mechanism for compliance in the Shasta. But with respect to the Scott, we are considering that we might be able to integrate the existing Scott waiver and that existing waiver may suffice because that waiver is part of the existing Scott River TMDL action plan. So these waivers are intended to address all of the key sources, including nutrients, sediment, and temperature. So in the case of the Scott, again, because the Scott River TMDL was for sediment and temperature, the nutrient control elements of the grazing and irrigated ag waivers are, in theory anyway, new, though our TMDL staff that's implementing the Scott River TMDL has thought, given this a lot of thought, and any measures to control sediment as part of the sediment TMDL are the same type of measures that are needed to control nutrients. There are another couple of other final points that I want to make, that the development of this Klamath River TMDL action plan will also serve as an action plan for some existing EPA-approved technical TMDLs. So those include the Lost River Dissolved Oxygen and pH TMDL and the South Fork Trinity Temperature TMDL. So our new Klamath TMDL action plan would serve as action plans for those two sub-watersheds. And in addition, that this action plan would partially, though not fully, serve as action plans for the Main Stem and South Fork Trinity sediment TMDLs. Okay, so you've been very patient. Moving to next steps and closing up, again, reminder to all of us that we're in public comment period, so we are looking forward to receiving written comments from the public by the close of that public comment period, which is on the 27th of this month, of August. Then leading to our next workshop before you, where we will present to you the types of things that we've been hearing in oral comments outside of board meetings, as well as any written comments that we get. We chose to do that workshop in Siskiyou County, knowing that there are a lot of folks that care a lot about this TMDL in Siskiyou County. So we wanted to have that workshop be in the area where we anticipate getting a lot of comments, and we need to hear them. But then to have the final hearing at the mouth of the Klamath River in the town of Klamath. With that said, that concludes my presentation that went longer than it should have. I appreciate your time, but welcome more questions and comments.
Mr. Corbett.
Yes, I just had two. First, I want to compliment staff on certain things that you're doing really good. And the first is you are going to all the communities to be heard. And despite a lot of passions in the Klamath community, you've presented a good, a calm, and a professional approach, and I really appreciate that. You aren't shirking any of the very diverse Klamath communities. The second is, it is a very remarkable thing when you're talking about two EPA regions and two states coming forth in a relatively short amount of time with an agreed-upon product, and you're proving that government can work across political boundaries and that a watershed approach can be used across political boundaries. And I think it's real simple when it comes to us, but I want to thank Oregon. I want to thank EPA Region 9 and 10 and yourselves for your leadership on showing how that can be done. And it's so much superior to the interstate conflict provisions of the Clean Water Act. So just to get all these different governmental agencies here to the table on time and actually in agreement is a tremendous accomplishment. I just wanted to thank you.
Anyone else? Mr. Massey.
Not only would I echo what Mr. Corbett said, but I think also for our staff. I'm quite sure that a number of coffee grounds have been killed and brown bottles emptied in the process of thinking about how do you put this together. I think much of what you've done is very innovative in terms of thinking through how do you accomplish this, and for that you need to be commended. That we ask questions doesn't mean we don't agree, only that it's like we haven't thought about that before. So I think all of us are in that sense having not only are you as agencies coming together, but it's also a chance for all of us to ask a lot of questions. Matt, you made one statement as you closed up on your next to last slide that the controls for sediment and nutrients are much the same, if not the same. I guess my feeling is a lot of sediment is roads, and I don't see where the connection is with the nutrients. Can you?
Yeah, that was a too broad of a statement on my part.
Okay.
And you're absolutely correct that that there are differences. But what I was trying to say is that if you're adequately controlling sediment in a basin like the Scott, for the most part, you should then be controlling nutrient sources. Now, the exception, which our grazing waiver is intended to address, the basin-wide one, is that there are nutrient or organic matter inputs from cattle through direct discharge that perhaps aren't controlled, that can't be controlled by sediment control measures. So that is an area that would essentially isn't a direct overlap.
I guess my question was, is there a big hole in my knowledge? And it sounds like, no, I'm okay. Thank you.
Those that were here yesterday, he's okay as self-described being okay. Mr. Corbett.
I just wanted to ask a procedural question. Are we going to take any public testimony because it's a workshop or not?
I have one speaker card.
Okay, I'm going to wait till after the public testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Norton.
Scott, Matt, I also want to thank you for your work and staff work. I want to thank all staff on this. Some questions. I hear what's in front of us, and I see some of what's behind us as far as implementing some of the programmatic pieces that need to fall into place here. It's a bit daunting to me to sit here and think about what's in front of us, both as a board and as staff. And a question would be, what are projected staffing requirements? Can we cover this? Because every time that I think about a TMDL, we essentially take a staff member and drop them off the airplane, parachute them in, and we have one less person on the airplane. And we have a lot in front of us here. This is a big road to hoe. And staffing requirements are one part of it. And then also I would similarly ask board requirements, because we're going to have a piece of this to put in, whether it be, I think we did part of that last time with our timber waiver on private lands. We have some federal timber waiver coming. How does that jive with what the current climate, and how do we get there? Because to me, this is such an important thing. On the implementation side, it's game on, and we're all in here. So how do we do that?
They're going to defer to me on this one. You're right on. We have dropped someone off of the airplane with each of our adopted TMDLs, and that's worked really well for us. And one of our remaining concerns is, who do we drop off the plane for the Lost River as well as the main stem? And we're looking at, we've got an offer of help from US EPA for part of that staffing, for which I'm grateful, as well as we're thinking of perhaps Clayton, that will be a big chunk of his time for the future. It will reduce what we're able to put into the Russian River TMDL, which will be the next one. I mean, that's essentially the cost, is assuming we continue to have a TMDL budget. What we've tried really hard to do is work in making these recommendations in the draft, to work them through the work that we're already aligned to do. So, for instance, on timber, what you see there is work that we're already committed to do. We have already made the commitment through the Scott and the Scott TMDL and the Salmon TMDL to work with the Forest Service to develop a comprehensive approach for those two watersheds, and we're seeing those as pilots for the larger. And I know you've heard Mr. Clamp talk about this, so I feel that to the extent that this was work we were already planning to do, we already have on our plates, it's already staffed, I feel pretty good about that. I'm worried about the grazing waiver, quite frankly. We don't have the expertise in the office to do it. There aren't many grazing waivers done yet statewide. There isn't a lot of expertise to be offered from the state level. So that's when I'm really kind of worried about where we begin, how we do that. We have Ms. Harris, who of course will be a great resource for us on this. But that's when I'm really worried about, along with leaving Clayton behind in the Lost River.
Well, and in some of those, I think we get great benefit by having geographic expertise. When we have staff essentially, for lack of a, well, to continue with the metaphor, parachute into a watershed and be resident there. I think it's also very important because this is the very farthest end of our jurisdictional reach here that we need to have a presence out there. I'm actually very glad to hear that, you know, the Lost River as a managing agency agreement, I think that that's an excellent first step to get to the Lost. Because I think that needs to be done. I think the straight strain issue is a big issue. And to hear that maybe that straight strain gets handled potentially through a creative solution with an offset may be a big win-win. But I think that we have real expertise on the north end up there with staff, and I think that's important. I think it's equally important because I'm sure we're going to hear from the community out there the importance to get to some of these other TMDLs. How we do that, I don't need an answer on that because I don't know either. I think it's daunting. I also would ask from the standpoint of the board, I mean, we have some big things coming to us that need to fall in place here as well. It's not just simply passing a TMDL. We have programmatic pieces here. A grazing waiver is a perfect example of that. And I see that as being equally as hard because, as I heard you say, Matt, and correct me if I'm wrong, the NPDES permitting is limited. We have limited NPDES permitting. We essentially have Iron Gate Hatchery as a permitted NPDES facility. Everything else is going to fall under a waiver or a prohibition or some other mechanism. And to me, some of those other mechanisms are harder to handle because they're not end-of-pipe stuff. It's all that non-point source stuff.
Yep. It's a big workload for you and for us.
If I may, I think one of the things that we're struggling with as staff, and I think the board has wrestled with as well, is when we look at a sector, whether it's roads or it's grazing, how narrowly do we craft a waiver? I mean, when you craft a waiver more narrowly, it's easier to get through. On the other hand, when we try to do these just with given our resources one basin at a time, we're not able to get everywhere where we feel like we need to. So I think that's just one of the things that we're going to need to, and I think the roads example that we talked about earlier is a perfect example. Four counties within this TMDL, the fifth Mendocino that's within the 5C program, you know, it seems to me logical that we'd be probably recommending that we would include Mendocino when we do that, so we would get a larger coverage within, so approaching it more programmatically than perhaps just on watershed lines. So it's just a struggle back and forth of how we deploy our resources basin-wide versus region-wide.
Well, and at the same time, I would encourage staff to reach out to some of these other agencies. We don't need to be always leading this charge. We can walk in step, I think, with some of these other agencies, whether it be Bureau of Reclamation or some of the private entities out there or tribal, whatever it is. I encourage the synergy of going and making those relationships. I think, staff, you have done a good job. I think we need to be there. I think we need to invest into that because we're going to get a bang for the buck. And something like the Lost River is a perfect example. You know, if we simply roll into this Lost River Basin, we're probably going to be chased either with sharp sticks. And it would be a lot better, I think, to have partnering agencies there and however that happens, to get that synergy done. It helps us. It helps with the overall benefit of what we're trying to do. And programmatically, I think that's where we need to go. So I would encourage that.
Yeah. And I'd just like to highlight on roads, I really feel like we've gotten there between the northern counties, the 5C program, and the recommendation that we will make to you that we will use that as the basis for a waiver. It's a partnership, and it's a partnership that's quite a few different entities involved in it. Just as you saw for the MS4, we're looking at the 4C for the southern county. So using those programs and those partners who are doing a really good job on the ground implementing the kind of controls we want to see and using their work as the basis to basically throw a waiver out that picks up what they're already doing.
Thank you.
If I could just add one final thing to that. Our vision, again, is that the Water Quality Improvement Accounting and Tracking Program will allow for the framework for the regulated community to come up with projects on their own, obviously then with our blessing from the standpoint of how they meet TMDL requirements, but it gives them the tools to implement projects that they come up with in concert with other local watershed groups like RCDs or watershed councils. And we think that there's incredible opportunity for getting the job done through that mechanism.
Well, at the same time as we develop temperature TMDL shade requirements, some of these other kind of ancillary pieces to the overall greater puzzle of implementation, do you foresee that the time it takes that to permeate into either an existing waiver or program or something like that as well, or a permit that's out there, there's going to be a time frame here, and your one kind of matrix up there showed some of that. I would imagine it's much broader than that. It probably time frames are much longer than that, too. On the same front, state line and attainment of the reduced bar graph at state line is daunting as well, I'm sure, for Oregon. And we assume compliance at state line to get our compliance in check on the rest of what we're actually receiving Oregon water here over an interstate boundary. And so I assume that all moves in parallel, too, and so there's sustained efforts and everything that goes along with that.
That's right.
You want to say something? Well, just to speak to the accounting and tracking concept and the relationship of that to non-point source controls on a farm-by-farm basis. By the way, David Leland of your staff. I haven't identified myself as yet. In Oregon, we can see that there's a gap between the ability to affect those farm-by-farm improvements and the much nearer term need for water quality improvement in the river. And the accounting and tracking and the centralized treatment ideas are intended as a way to help bridge that gap with things that can be accomplished sooner, while some of these other programs that have a longer term time frame and are a little bit more sluggish to show results can gear up and have their effect. So we see a meshing there of these two ideas.
Yeah, I do too. And the thing is too is I think we're good to I think allow the flexibility of implementation on the regulated community. If we simply go in there and put everything in place that's rigid, it's a recipe for failure. And we would be better off, and it sounds like what we're implementing, the tracking and system that you're talking about and the creative pollution trading, or however we do this, however it is done, and it's not just it's we in a greater sense and everybody in play here, that I think that's important to leave that flexibility, because we would, I think, have a better chance of success giving flexibility and self-implementation or implementation that's voluntary rather than regulatory. That strictly regulatory, we're going to come at you if you don't do it. That may be in fact true, but from the standpoint of we're allowing flexibility to get it done, show us how you're going to get it done. And I think that's really important. So I would encourage that as well. I think that thinking outside the box here and things that are being talked about, I think, are good. I think that's realistic. And it adds a sense of control to the regulated community out there in how this thing's going to go. And I think that's really important.
Okay. I do have two speaker cards. I'm going to go to that now. Vivian Hellowell, followed by Daniel Meyer. I assume, Daniel, I have your card. I assume it's on this item. I didn't call that out.
Vivian Hellowell. Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations and Institute for Fisheries Resources. Hello, Chairman Anderson and members of the board. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today.
And just to interrupt, but I'm going to make this pitch to everybody today. I mean, we've allowed staff lengthy time, but I wanted for the board create a solid foundation because this item is not a small one and we're going to have to live with it. But as we go forward throughout the day, there will be lots of comment. I'm going to keep people to 3 minutes and ask you to give us your comments as briefly as you can. So thank you. Sorry for that.
Thank you. We have submitted written comments, and we will be submitting further written comments. So this is a brief, especially thank you to the staff for the great work that you've been doing on this. Fishing for salmon is held to the precautionary principle, and so we've had essentially no ocean fishing for salmon for 2 years now. Many people have received federal disaster relief, but that won't be continuing. And we have at least a dozen people who've gone to Alaska to fish this summer, so that income won't come into California. We want to say that very good on use of waivers. It's great that the cold water refuge is not to be further impacted by sediment. We need to do better than the forest practice rules, include the tribs, not just the main stem. That's real good about the Shasta. Specifically, we need to limit road densities, limit crossings, road crossings, relocate roads out of the stream zones, and limit clear cutting in the rain on snow zone between 3,000 and 5,000 feet, where you have rain on snow events that cause a lot of erosion. Keeping cows out of the creek except where they need to drink is a good idea too. Part two, on water flows and nutrients. We think it's very good that the staff is recognizing that you can't fix the Klamath without fixing the Lost River and the Keno Reach. Hot Lost River wastewater dumps into Tule Lake and Lower Klamath Lake. And we need to get real about restoring marshes, which act as giant water filters. We need buffers in the wildlife refuge, which has been used considerably for grazing for a long time. And thanks for dealing with the reservoirs that heat up the nutrient-rich water. And this is a really interesting idea about this credit for offsets in the tracking program. I just want to thank the board for dealing with pollution in the Klamath. It's very, very important to our coastal fishing communities that we have a living river with, and that you're protecting the beneficial uses for our coastal communities. We have communities up and down the coast that rely on fish from the Klamath River for our communities and our family fishing businesses. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Daniel Meyer.
Good morning. I'm Daniel Myers. I'm representing the Redwood chapter of the Sierra Club. I was really pleased to hear the report from staff. I like what's happening. I just have one issue I wanted to bring up, that at the last workshop, I asked the staff how they were doing with the furlough plan and the lack of losing 2 working days a month. And they said it makes it more difficult, and I asked if it's impeding the progress, and they said, yes, it is causing us some loss of effort in that. And I just got the EPA report a week or so ago, and they indicate that they're still funding this project at 3.7 personnel, 100%, yet we're only paying our folks 90% of what they, and we're not getting that full value. I think it would be worthwhile to investigate examining whether certain employees could be exempted from the furlough program if they are being funded fully by the federal government. And essentially, we're taking that money. It's not being expended. It would be better for the economy of both the federal government and the state government if we had the employees on this project. And this project is much too important to give it a 90% effort when it needs 110% effort. And we talked about the various things that needed to go into it. You know, we need a riparian protection and wetland work plan. That would provide much of what we've talked about here today is giving it an approach that would help people to do it on a voluntary basis. I don't know what's happened to that plan, but I just want to see us keep this thing on keel. I want to see it do well, and I think it's worth investigating to put in our staff back at full time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Anyone else? Gail, you want to give us some insight?
Good morning. I'm Gail Louie with EPA in Region 9, San Francisco. Been working with your staff for several years now on Klamath Basin issues and TMDLs, and I just really want to commend your staff and the board for taking this on and for really being quite creative and innovative in terms of the implementation. And I think we look forward to working with you and look forward to your board adoption of the TMDLs, and hopefully we can avoid a federal promulgation on a TMDL. But I also just want to mention that, Mr. Noren, you brought up some, I think, really good suggestions with regard to partnerships with different agencies and entities. And I think, for example, just working on this clam track concept that Matt described with PacifiCorps is a good example of the start of that. And I think there are also many other examples of places where there are basin-wide issues and federal irrigation projects where we have been able to do that sort of thing, such as the Grasslands Bypass Project, and trying to structure some sort of approach where you have some sort of overall regulatory structure, but then you enable the ability for local entities to determine what's appropriate on a district basis or even an individual landowner basis. And so I think we would like to continue working with you on that. And as Kat mentioned, we are trying to provide some staff support from our agency to help on Lost River implementation. So thank you very much.
Maybe it's not in your bailiwick, but in terms of the monitoring and tracking as a concept, is there money for such things? Is that further down the road, and we'll deal with that at a later point?
As Matt mentioned earlier, we have provided some money under the stimulus funding, and so we've been able to provide a little bit of funding for some contractor support, and that's to complement and support the effort that PacifiCorps is funding. And I note that one of the consultants that's working on that is in the audience here, Dave Smith, and we're looking forward to really bringing more resources, because I think it's going to take a lot of effort to get that off the ground. But we have a little bit of funding to get that going, and certainly we're going to be looking to see if we can bring other funding, and hopefully working both with Oregon and with Region 10 as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe that concludes on Klamath, unless, Mr. Corbett, sorry.
I just wanted to have a couple quick things. One, this is not directly related to the Klamath TMDL, but we had previously adopted narrative language, and I believe this is the time period to bring that up as part of the overall basin plan amendment. Two, I want to point out we have an enormous investment in the basin plan regulatory structure, because that's the vehicle being used for TMDLs. And I would hope that we would use it to get as much done as we reasonably need to get done, and use the considerable sums and public hearings we already have invested in that vehicle. Third, there are going to be, when we have our waste load allocations, probably several different scientific models and approaches, and we need to have a system where we can give full consideration to those models as they come up, and to also keep things moving. That's more a heads up. And it's already been discussed from the board, but I think whenever possible, when we have applicable uses for the Klamath TMDL implementation plan that can be used for implementation plans and other TMDLs, I think that's really a wise approach. And so I appreciate you going forward on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other board member questions, comments? Board's going to take a 10-minute recess. We'll be back 10:40. All right. Board's back in session. We're going to go to item